Welcome to the Lowy Institute. Human rights are an important part of the work of any organisation that devotes itself to international relations. At the Lowy Institute, we've done a substantial amount of work on several aspects of human rights, including significant bodies of work on the death penalty in Indonesia, on the international refugee protection regime, and on the importance of democracy here in Australia and in the region. Our online magazine, The Interpreter, regularly presents work on aspects of human rights. We've hosted human rights leaders such as the global head of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, last year, and we are very honoured to have the Commissioner here tonight. Unsurprisingly, Australians champion human rights, almost without exception. We know from our own work that they believe in basic rights such as voting, fair trials, and free media. Most are against the death penalty in Indonesia. In an early Lowy Institute poll, 94% of Australians said that promoting human rights in other countries was an important foreign policy goal. One arm of the global human rights agenda, which is gaining attention and momentum, is modern slavery. When we think of slavery, it's possible that many regard it as a largely historical phenomenon, something that plagued the southern states of America a couple of hundred years ago but has little contemporary relevance. Tragically, that's not the case. I know the Commissioner is going to give you some fairly shocking statistics when he speaks, but suffice to say, according to one reliable estimate, the number of people in slavery today falls not far short of one in every 200 people on earth. The Atlantic slave trade started with Portuguese traders in the 1400s, extended to America with the Spanish trade in African slaves, which started during the Renaissance. Slavery was legalised in Massachusetts in the 17th century, and by the 18th century, the slave trade accounted for around 80% of Britain's foreign income. When slavery was abolished by law in 1833, it's fair to say that most of us thought that that was largely the end of the problem. Far from it. In the 21st century, slaves are increasing in number, and there are, in fact, more slaves today than ever before in human history, and that profits amount to hundreds of billions each year. Trafficking is both a global and a local problem. It even happens here in Australia, one of the most prosperous nations on earth. Most investigations here have been focused on sexual exploitation. Just 2 weeks ago, a teenage African girl escaped from servitude and sought help at a refuge in Newtown in inner Sydney. To take us through some of the issues and the challenges in modern traffic and slavery, we have a very distinguished guest today. Gavin Hyland, OBE, is the United Kingdom's first independent anti-slavery commissioner. The commissioner's role was created as one of the key provisions of the UK's 2015 Modern Slavery Act. Mr. Hyland took on the role in late 2014, but he's been working on human trafficking for most of his career. For 30 years, he was a police officer specialising in serious organised crime, including homicide, anti-corruption, and human trafficking and slavery. He was responsible for the convictions of many international organised crime groups and the prosecution of various criminal offences, including money laundering, corruption, sexual exploitation, and human trafficking. Inevitably, he rose to the head of the London Metropolitan Police Service's Human Trafficking Unit. He helped to establish the anti-human trafficking organisation, the Santa Marta Group, which was launched by Pope Francis of the Vatican in April 2014, which comprises international law enforcement agencies, civil society, non-governmental organisations and the Catholic Church. He was appointed Officer of the Order of the British Empire for services to combating human trafficking in the 2015 New Year's Honours. Mr. Hyland has said in the past that his job shouldn't exist. I am therefore in a quandary. I am torn between being dismayed that it does, but pleased on our own behalf that it does, because it means that we have a person of such standing here in Australia who can bring his immense experience to bear on our own government's thinking on Australia's anti-trafficking regime. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Kevin Hyland.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And firstly, thank you to Alex and the Institute for inviting me here to talk to you about such a crucially important issue. As the UK's first appointed independent anti-slavery commissioner, my role, as you heard, is to spearhead the UK's efforts to tackle modern slavery, both domestically and internationally. To enable me to do this, I have statutory powers over all law enforcement, border security, local government, and health bodies. The legislation also makes clear that my role is about encouraging international join-up, as this is often a crime that crosses borders. The role was created by the Modern Slavery Act, which received royal assent in March 2015. The Act is the first of its kind in Europe and one of the first in the world to specifically tackle slavery and trafficking in the 21st century. And I believe it will be looked back on as a landmark piece of legislation. I have the pleasure of being in Australia this week because your Parliamentary Joint Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade is currently undertaking an inquiry looking at whether Australia should enact its own Modern Slavery Act. As I outlined in my evidence to the committee yesterday, the Act has given our criminal justice actors enhanced tools to tackle this crime and has improved support and protection for victims and survivors, though we are still at the beginning of the journey and much more remains to be done. The Act signalled the intention of the United Kingdom to once again be a world leader in the fight against slavery, as we were in the days of William Wilberforce. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, who pushed the legislation through when she was previously Home Secretary, has described modern slavery as the great human rights issue of our time. But given that we are gathered here this evening at Australia's leading foreign affairs think tank, rather than just concentrate on the domestic situation in the UK, I want to focus tonight on how we can work better internationally to tackle this crime. But first, for the sake of clarity, what exactly do I mean by the term modern slavery? Well, it's an umbrella term covering a number of often related serious abuses, including forced labour, child slavery, and all forms of trafficking in persons, including for sexual exploitation, forced criminality, organ removals, and domestic servitude. The Modern Slavery Act includes two clear offences that covers this spectrum: the offence of slavery, servitude and forced labour, and the offence of human trafficking. In few other crimes are human beings used as commodities over and over again for the gain of others. Victims endure experiences that are horrifying in their inhumanity. And these are individuals who have often experienced other forms of exploitation, poverty or poor health prior to being enslaved. Their vulnerabilities are multiplied many times over by their experiences at the hands of traffickers and slave drivers. Stripped of their freedom and often exploited for profit, the damage inflicted on victims is incalculable. The slavery we see today exists for the same purposes as it has throughout history: to maximise profit for exploitators by minimising or eliminating the cost of labour. The International Labour Organization estimates that the total illegal profits obtained from modern slavery crime worldwide amount to over $150 billion. This makes it one of the top three most profitable illicit global enterprises, this money being earned year on year. Slavery has, of course, existed for thousands of years, but economic and social forces have enabled its alarming resurgence in the past few decades. Population explosions has tripled the number of people in the world, mostly in developing countries. In many places, the population has grown faster than the economy, leaving many people economically vulnerable. And millions are migrating, moving from impoverished rural areas to cities and from poorer countries to wealthier ones in search of work. Criminals are able to deceive them by posing as legitimate labour recruiters. Modern slavery is often a hidden crime, which means that it is difficult to obtain reliable estimates of the scale of the problem. But as we heard, Australia's own Walk Free Foundation last year estimated that there were almost 46 million victims of modern slavery across the globe. And back in 2012, the United Nations International Labour Organization conservatively estimated that there were 21 million victims. I am pleased that the two bodies are now working together to share their data in order to provide a joint estimate, which should be published later this year. As the Walk Free Foundation has worked tirelessly to state, In the year 2017, modern slavery exists in every country across the globe. Nowhere is immune. So how can we work better together as an international community to tackle this evil trade in human lives? I have four suggestions that I would like to share with you tonight. My first recommendation is for all relevant actors, particularly governments and their law enforcement and security agencies, as well as multilateral organisations, to ensure they treat modern slavery in line with the gravity of the crime and the severity of the threat, and that they then deploy commensurate resources against it. This means ensuring that we are fully informed about the nature of modern slavery and how it feeds into or off related serious abuses. We need to see it for what it is. Serious and often organised crime, generating huge profits for transnational crime groups, off of the suffering of millions and millions of people across the globe. We need to step up the response. High potential profits and a historical low risk of punishment has made modern slavery an attractive enterprise for criminals. We need to be clear on the links between modern slavery and other serious crime and the implications for the level of prioritisation we devote to countering it. Modern slavery is intrinsically linked to human security and economic development. Organised criminals are known to use the profits from trafficking and slavery to fund other illicit activities, including weapons smuggling and terrorism. Terrorist organisations, including Daesh and Boko Haram, now openly advocate slavery as a tactic of war and use the profits to fund their attacks. Daesh has even established slave markets where women and children are sold with price tags attached. Conflict in Syria, the wider Middle East, and also in Asia, including Western Burma, has also produced an environment that has enabled slavery to flourish. Men, women, and children fleeing conflict are extremely vulnerable to numerous forms of modern slavery, including sexual exploitation, forced labour, and even organ trafficking. Long-established transnational organised crime groups are also using power vacuums caused by instability and conflict to scale up their trafficking operations. I will outline one such example, the trafficking of Nigerian women and girls, later in my presentation. Globally, perhaps, the most shocking related crisis in the modern day slave trade is now booming in Libya. Current political, military, and social conditions have created an environment where traffickers have thrived. Militias are rounding up migrants en masse, placing them in detention facilities where they are beaten and subjected to forced labour or sexual exploitation until their families pay a ransom to allow passage to Europe. These detention centres are forced labour camps set up specifically to profit from the organised exploitation of migrants. In October last year, the International Organization for Migration reported that over 70% of all migrants taking the central Mediterranean routes connecting North Africa to Europe had experienced exploitation and human trafficking. Libya is the location where the vast majority of abuses are reported. I met Sarah, an extremely vulnerable 15-year-old Eritrean girl, at a reception camp in Lampedusa last year. Sarah had been kidnapped and held for 3 months in Libya in a so-called connection house, where she was sexually exploited multiple times every day. And if migrants do reach Europe, Europol, Europe's policing agency, have confirmed that traffickers are increasingly targeting vulnerable refugees, including unaccompanied children, in EU countries. Indeed, one of my biggest concerns at the moment is the rapidly increasing prevalence of exploitation of refugees. Where in the past trafficking and slavery was, in general, a distinct concept to the migration smuggling, whilst the two remain legally distinct, the nexus between the crimes seems to be growing ever closer across the globe. Data from Europol from 2015 indicates that the suspected migrant smugglers linked to other types of crime form 20% of those linked to human trafficking. And the agency has detected that criminal gangs, which have previously been known to be involved in human trafficking, are now appearing in the organisation's files in relation to migrant smuggling. A paper published by the Lowy Institute last September also stated that in Southeast Asia, the line between people smuggling and human trafficking is becoming especially blurred, including with regards to the 2015 Rohingya crisis. Unfortunately, up until now, tackling slavery and trafficking simply has not been a priority for national or international law enforcement and security services. But given the current context, there can be no doubt that law enforcement and intelligence agencies must prioritise efforts to increase cross-border collaboration to investigate, disrupt and dismantle human trafficking networks that are profiting from conflict and human suffering. We need to use tools and learning from efforts against other forms of organised crime and terrorism. In the UK, things are now beginning to change. We now have a modern slavery task force, which brings together the heads of our intelligence and law enforcement agencies to drive high-level operational action in the UK and in priority countries. We need high-profile convictions of the organisers to act as a deterrent to others. This can be achieved through increased use of joint investigation teams, multilateral prosecutions, and data and intelligence sharing. We also need to get smarter at debriefing victims and sensitively sharing this information with law enforcement and victim support agencies to inform both disruption and protection efforts. My second point is to be clear, however, that prosecution-focused efforts alone will not be enough. We need to focus on the victims, both post-exploitation and also before it actually takes place, i.e. to understand the vulnerabilities that cause people to become susceptible to exploitation and working to help increase their resilience. This means, where possible, looking at root causes. In line with the increased law enforcement-centred resources, we must also increase resources to ensure a victim-centred response. This is a crime that destroys lives, and morally, there can be no doubt that the well-being of those affected must be at the very heart of the response. But effective support for victims will also help increase the numbers of prosecutions. When made to feel safe, victims will be much more inclined to come forward and share their accounts, which helps build a better picture of the criminality and feeds into an improved law enforcement response. And until we work more strategically to tackle modern slavery at its root, including focusing on the vulnerabilities that traffickers target, we can at best only ever hope to apply band-aid solutions. This means focusing on modern slavery as an international development priority. Human development and slavery have, of course, always been closely linked. Victims endure experiences that are horrifying in their inhumanity, including violence, rape and extreme abuse. But modern slavery also has wider negative implications for human development. It results in a huge loss of remittances to developing countries, because remittance flows are taken from the victims, who are forced to pay off debts, which become profits for the criminals. And there is the impact on the families and communities left behind. Victims cannot care for their children or the elderly. Many are young, so modern slavery robs communities of those that could economically contribute most to local development. Modern slavery is an economic problem, as many victims are seeking to escape poverty and are lured into trafficking and slavery by the false promises of economic gain. It is a health problem, as trafficked women and children are most at risk of HIV infection and related harm. And it is a legal problem, as victims are stripped of their human rights. In spite of all this, until very recently, modern slavery and development have been largely treated as separate policy areas. Whilst modern slavery crime worldwide is estimated to generate over $150 billion per year in illegal profits, OECD countries spend just 0.08% of this amount on anti-slavery development assistance. So as an international community, we hadn't really given ourselves a chance. An opportunity to change this arose during the drafting of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. These were, of course, the targets that now set the international community's sustainable development efforts and associated funding commitments up until the year 2030. Unfortunately, initially, there was no clear target on tackling modern slavery. Working with a number of partners, including the Vatican, where Pope Francis's moral leadership on this issue has been extraordinary, I worked to secure an explicit target to eradicate modern slavery, Goal 8.7, which all member states have signed up to. This now places the fight against modern slavery exactly where it should have been, as part of the strategy to promote sustainable and long-term development. Through the adoption of the SDGs, member states have now have made an unequivocal global commitment to take immediate and effective measures to eradicate modern slavery by 2030. Following the adoption of SDG 8.7, I am pleased that the UK has now made tackling modern slavery an international development priority. A £33.5 million international modern slavery fund has been established to fund prevention efforts in countries of origin. It has also, for the first time, become a core priority for our Department for International Development, which will be developing new programming in endemic areas of the world. I've been working with the government to focus on targeting the best opportunities for prevention. One such example is through targeting the trafficking of women and girls from Nigeria to Europe. This is in fact one of the most urgent trafficking flows currently taking place across the globe. Since we began recording figures in 2009, Nigeria has consistently been one of the top countries of origin of victims of modern slavery identified in the UK. Indeed, for decades, transnational traffickers have operated from southern Nigeria, deceiving victims with false promises of better lives in Europe. But these criminals are now taking advantage of conflict and instability in the Lake Chad Basin and in Libya, and have massively scaled up their trafficking operations by utilising these now ungoverned routes. In 2016, over 11,000 Nigerian women arrived in Italy from Libya. This is an eightfold increase from the numbers arriving in 2014. The International Organization for Migration, which has counter-trafficking experts based at disembarkation points in Italy, believes that 80% are trafficking victims destined for exploitation in brothels across Europe, including the UK. I was recently told that smugglers and traffickers are now reserving spaces on vessels in Libya for Nigerian females, as they are so much more valuable to criminals than individuals of any other nationality. In reality, many of the Nigerian females registering as adults when they reach Italy are in fact girls. Agencies confirm that they deny being children even when they are clearly underage, because they have been instructed by those exploiting them to avoid the child protection system. If they are placed in an adult centre, it is much easier for them to leave to meet their traffickers, who at that point they are still likely to trust. Nigerian girls who arrive in Italy by sea are mostly aged between 15 to 17, though agencies have recently noted an increasing proportion of even younger girls arriving aged just 13. To avoid violence and extortion towards them or their families in Nigeria, the girls are forced to carry out sex work under conditions of slavery for periods ranging from 3 to 7 years. This is one of the most brutal forms of trafficking that I've encountered. The exploitation begins far in advance of reaching Europe's shores. During the journey overland, the girls suffer abuse and violence at the hands of their traffickers. Again, the exploitation suffered in Libya is often especially shocking. Those who insist they will not work as prostitutes are tied up in the position called the crocodile. Their hands are tied to their feet, and they are left for days without food or water. Some are left to die as an example to others. Incredibly, despite the numbers involved, Nigerian victims who are trafficked to Europe for sexual exploitation disproportionately originate from one relatively small area, Edo State in the south of the country. The UNODC and Nigeria's anti-trafficking agency together report that over 90% of Nigerian females trafficked to Europe for sexual exploitation originate from Edo State. The state's capital, Benin City, is well established as Nigeria's trafficking hub. To provide some context, at the time of officials' figures in the 2006 census, the population of Edo State was little over 3 million, which represents just 1.8% of Nigeria's total population of 174 million. Yet there has been no strategic response at source. European countries of destination and international agency have had little interest in Edo. Women and girls have been pouring into Italy, quickly disappearing before being controlled and abused by organised crime groups across Europe, making huge profits for them. The cost to these girls is, of course, enormous. I have met many survivors, and few have been able to recover from the brutality they have suffered. They often contract sexual infections and HIV. Many actually die whilst under control of the criminals. Perversely, at present, the best case scenario is sometimes for them to suffer for years only to become under the wing of their traffickers, to be groomed themselves, to become madams and part of the criminal chain. The cost to European states is also huge, from the cost of care when victims are eventually identified to the social and economic costs wreaked by the transnational crime groups. I have visited Edo on several occasions, and the opportunities for strategic prevention there is huge. Tackling the root causes is complex, but with investments in expertise and working with frontline groups, it can be done. Prevention is, of course, always better than cure, and the sums of money involved with working strategically at source pale into insignificance compared with the current loss of doing nothing and then picking up the pieces in Europe. So I've been working in partnership with development experts and local stakeholders, including the University of Benin, which has completed extensive work identifying the root causes of this phenomenon and the interventions required. Following three visits to Nigeria last summer, I put forward a case for action to the UK government to support prevention activity in Edo, alongside initial recommendations. My recommendations focused on strengthening frontline NGOs and faith groups that could access the most vulnerable and hard-to-reach communities through community mobilisation efforts. My report also looked at how the UK could bolster local rule of law efforts, as criminals at present are operating with impunity. There are clear opportunities to build the capacity of Nigeria's anti-trafficking agency, as well as wider judicial capacity. And then we explored how smart investments could support the development of alternative livelihoods for vulnerable young people. I'm pleased to say that the case for action was accepted, and at least £5 million will be spent in Nigeria to develop solutions at source to prevent exploitation from occurring in the first place. This work is being led by our Home Office, but in addition, DFID has been tasked with looking at how they can bring its expertise to bear with regard to community mobilisation and cultural change efforts, as well as livelihoods development. I'm also clear that we need to bring a much more professional focus to monitoring and evaluation to this field, so that we can then understand exactly which interventions work, in which context, and how they can be scaled up. Going forward, all UK-funded projects will now have a strong M&E component built in from day one. My third point, and very relevant here in light of the current debate concerning the possibility of introducing a modern slavery act in Australia, is that we cannot ignore the crucial role that the private sector has to play in international efforts to prevent and address modern slavery, including in relation to development efforts and the provision of alternative livelihoods. If we look at the figures available of the more than 21 million people that the International Labour Organization estimated in 2012 to be exploited in forms of modern slavery across the globe, well over half, some 14 million, were estimated to be enslaved within the private sector economy. Many products we buy and use every day are unfortunately tainted by slavery. There is evidence of slavery in different stages of supply chains, from the production of raw materials such as cocoa, cotton, or fishing, to manufacturing of everyday goods such as mobile phones and clothes. Because of the complexity of modern slavery supply chains, typically a final product has passed through a long chain, and it is rarely possible to be certain that a product has or has not been produced using slave labour. So transparency is crucial. The Transparency Supply Chain Clause of the Modern Slavery Act requires every company with a turnover of more than £36 million operating in the UK, this being the UK's definition of a large company, to publish an annual slavery statement every year. This statement must set out what they are doing to address these issues in their supply chains and business operations. In this way, the Act has a very global reach, as the provisions cover some 12,000 companies. Organisations must include a link to the statement in a prominent place on the front page of their website. Through the Act, the UK was the first country in the world to take such a step. Companies have a moral responsibility for taking measures to ensure that no slavery has been used in producing the products they sell, and they must be held to this at the highest levels. This is why the Act requires statements to be signed off at board director level. In my view, this in particular has been a very powerful measure. We are starting to see major cultural change across many sectors in how this issue is viewed and treated. Since the passing of the Act, research by a leading UK business school has found that the engagement of CEOs with modern slavery issues has doubled. CEOs are realising that addressing modern slavery is becoming a business critical issue for credibility with customers, investors, and the general public. Bringing this all together, my fourth and final recommendation concerns the urgent requirement for much better coordination across the piece to ensure a holistic and strategic response. For states, this means developing integrated whole-of-government international strategies based on fully coordinated activity from our home and foreign ministries and international development and criminal justice agencies. In the UK, this is now beginning to take shape. The task force that I mentioned earlier, which I am a member of, is actually personally chaired by the Prime Minister. It brings together the heads of our intelligence and law enforcement agencies, together with ministers from relevant departments and the heads of Interpol and Europol, in order to more drive coordinated policy and operational action in the UK and in priority countries. Because we also need to improve coordination between states. We must focus more on how we can support source and transit countries to develop interventions, as I have outlined regarding Nigeria. But we also need to be smarter in working with our partners. For example, in Vietnam, this is a major source country of victims trafficked to the UK. Vulnerable young men and boys are brought to the UK to be forced to work in exploitation in cannabis factories. Vietnamese organised crime groups control the UK's cannabis trade. So the UK was looking to scale up its activity in Vietnam, including developing new capacity building projects. but the UK's footprint and overall influence in Vietnam is relatively limited. Australia, however, has a much larger presence there and has developed influential relationships over the years. I went to see a programme in Hanoi run by the Australian Federal Police in partnership with the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology. The programme identifies up-and-coming young law enforcement leaders from across Vietnam and provides leadership and technical training on contemporary crime threats, including trafficking and smuggling. It was amongst the best training related to this crime that I have seen yet. So rather than the UK trying to reinvent the wheel and start from scratch, I have recommended that we invest in the AFP programme and work with our Australian partners so that additional modules are being built in focusing on smuggling and trafficking threat to Europe and the UK, and identifying young leaders from the relevant source provinces. I'm pushing for the UK, Australia, and the US in particular to work much more closely together in developing our international anti-slavery strategies, to map out joint areas of concern and our assets and levels of influence in these areas, and then to develop so-called burden-sharing agreements so that we each take the lead in the areas of the world where we have the necessary knowledge, experience, and influence. This kind of coordination also needs to be developed at the multilateral level. At present, multilateral efforts against slavery are siloed and fragmented, with little effort made at a strategic join-up. Each silo within the multilateral system has its own focus, often overlapping, but rarely talking to one another. We have seen that the UNODC focuses on the criminal justice side, the IOM looking at migration and emergencies, the ILO working on forced labour. But until recently, there has been very little integration of these efforts. Tackling traffickers and protecting the vulnerable will only be achieved through utilising all levers at the international community's disposal. This means deploying the UN's leverage through deployment and humanitarian efforts and development, criminal justice capacity building, political work, and peacekeeping operations. Positively, this is slowly starting to happen. Again, this follows directly on from the adoption of SDG 8.7, which has really been a game changer in terms of the international prioritisation. A coordination group, Alliance 8.7, was launched last year at the UN's General Assembly in New York. Relevant UN agencies have all now come together in alliance, and a number of coordinated groups have been formed, focusing on areas including rule of law, supply chains, migration, and humanitarian emergencies. I have put forward several initial suggestions to the Emergencies Working Group, in particular for work that I believe needs to be immediately synchronised. Protection against slavery and trafficking have, totally wrongly, not been viewed as life-saving emergency aid. So at present, responses to slavery and trafficking in crisis are not systematically integrated into humanitarian responses. This refers to the absence of proactive identification, lack of training of frontline responders, and the need for effective debriefing and information sharing. This is urgent. On visits to reception centres, I witnessed how the current absence of integrated protection is resulting in potential victims not being identified and protected. Traffickers view refugee camps as a rich source of new victims. So proactive responses to protect against slavery and trafficking must be integrated into humanitarian responses to conflict and related emergencies. I've seen the positive impact that deployments of dedicated experts can have, including cultural mediators. But unfortunately, at present, this is the exception rather than the norm. I am also encouraging suitable training for UN peacekeepers, as they will often be operating across known routes used by traffickers in places such as Mali and Sudan. Now is the time for member states to demand a fit-for-purpose UN system that delivers strategically, coordinated and systemic anti-slavery and trafficking efforts, ideally through a single UN-agreed strategy. So in closing, the scale and impact of modern slavery crime is much greater than we had previously thought. It is feeding off conflict and crisis and has become a crime of choice for organised crime groups due to the historic levels of impunity available to them. Quite clearly, there's an urgent need for increased levels of cross-border law enforcement collaboration, for strategic prevention efforts at source, positive engagement with the private sector, and holistic international and multilateral strategies that join the dots together. The positive note is that there is change afoot. The Modern Slavery Act has brought a huge change in the UK's international efforts, and I can now see a similar process taking place here in Australia. And through the adoption of SDG 8.7, UN agency and member states from across the globe are also scaling up their activities and working to coordinate them. I recently briefed the UN Security Council, where over 70 member states spoke very strongly on the actions required. Until last year, the Security Council had never, ever before had one single debate on trafficking and slavery. So there is a momentum, but this kind of momentum is often fleeting. So we must work together to capture it now while it exists and do everything in our power to help translate it into positive and tangible action. To reiterate once again, through adoption of SDG 8.7, all UN member states have a commitment to take immediate action to end modern slavery within the next 13 years. Whilst this is a huge challenge, we must remember that it took William Wilberforce just 20 years to end the British slave trade, and it was less than 30 years more when the global slave trade was abolished. And this was a time when slavery was accepted as birth, marriage, and death. So now is the time to stop talking and start doing, as on this issue, like no other, we will be judged solely by our actions, not our words. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, for that magisterial review of not only the situation in the UK, but that globally. We have some 15 minutes, I think, for some questions.
Thank you, Kevin, for sharing your insights with us and for making the trip to Australia to share the UK perspective. My question relates to Section 54, which introduced the transparency measures for reporting for UK companies and for other companies that are subject to the provisions of the UK Act. I'm interested to hear from you about the impacts that you have seen that having on business practices and the extent to which you've seen or may not have seen that driving change in corporate practices by companies that are the subject of the Act.
Yeah, so as I said, this has to be signed off at board level. So the decision has to be made at a senior level and they hold the responsibility. So as I reported recently, I've seen some terrible statements, but I've also seen some outstanding statements. And we are seeing the cultural change. We are now seeing CEOs and companies seeing this as a priority and a number one priority. And some of the businesses, for example, some of our supermarkets, have gone beyond what we anticipated. They are making sure, putting every effort in to check their supply chains. But then they're going further to create models for supporting victims, offering employment to them. So they're really starting to put this as a priority and starting to get it as part of the culture of the business, which is actually why this part of the Act is not punitive, because we want to change the way that companies act, not just make them change for fear of being prosecuted. And we are seeing that they are changing their culture. And of course, those that are rising to the top and doing the statements, doing the quality statements, I can use that. Civil society can use that, NGOs, public, shareholders, so that we start pulling up those who are doing the poor statements. And we're already seeing that happen also. where people are being pointed out or called out because they've done poor, inadequate statements. So it's only the first year of reporting, and I see over the coming years that these will become very sophisticated reports, and there will be a rise to the top. There will be a race to the top.
The observation that your perspective is magisterial is correct, and what is very clear is that the problem is beyond a simple, narrow, legally defined problem. But still, legislation is an important part, it seems, of the UK response and internationally. Consistency in legislation internationally seems to be an important ingredient of a coordinated response. In your experience, is there a movement towards consistent implementation of legislation internationally?
Yeah, I mean, shockingly, I think nearly every country in the world has got human trafficking legislation, yet prosecutions stay very low, and that's the priority that's been put on this. So some countries are very similar, but none are inclusive, I would say, as much as the Modern Slavery Act that looks at all elements and looks at more than just criminal justice outcomes. But one of the things I think that there does need to be is that we've obviously come up with Section 54, which we've made non-punitive. I think there would be great benefit is as other countries create their transparency elements, there is a consistency, because we don't want different reporting regimes all over the world, because we're talking about the same companies. And then we can start creating so much confusion, because the company that operates in the UK or operates in Australia has two statements that are completely different. So I think that global link-up and that consistency is essential in this area, because particularly on supply chains, business is business, and they all operate different. Okay, we know there's different rules, whether it's in the EU and whether it's elsewhere in the world and there's other governance. But actually on this, about the way companies trade, I think there should be consistency, because that's essential to achieve the aim.
Yeah, I was very interested in your comments on the problem at the source. When you've had a great population explosion, unemployment, starvation, and somebody comes along and says, well, here's an opportunity, and you grab it because there's nothing else. And it reminds me that there are places, there are groups like the Grameen Bank is one. Another group I'm familiar with is Opportunity International, that works with these disadvantaged people and helps them create jobs. In the Philippines, for instance, I know Opportunity has over 1 million clients. And I'm wondering whether groups such as this could work with your committee in these countries to try and solve the problem at the source.
And that's exactly what needs to happen. Groups like that need to be identified, worked with, collaborated with, so that sustainable development opportunities, whether that's through loans or whether that's through training. One group that I'm working with is, for example, the McCain Institute, looking at how we can work in areas like Nigeria to give education opportunities, identify leaders so that they can lead from within the company and they can get leadership training. But I think that's essential. And that's what the join-up I'm talking about. At the moment, it's all it's all fragmented, disorganized, and we need to look at opportunities like that. And that's exactly the kind of thing that I look at. And then how we can use our international development and our funding that we've got and our resources to actually complement, not just to turn up and rewrite or remake the wheel, but actually to complement what's already going on.
Thank you for that talk. It's really informative. I was wondering, what is the relevance of some other local policies? So, for instance, in Australia, there's some suggestion that our focus on illegal migration makes it hard for law enforcement to have a more victim-focused approach when they find victims who are essentially being trafficked, but they're illegal immigrants. And also, if there's any connection between the criminalisation of prostitution or the sex trade in a country and how profitable it might mean for them to traffic women and girls.
So, the immigration status of an individual, I think, is a big barrier. And recently, one of the recommendations I made to our government was about the fact that the way victims were being assessed, part of that included immigration status being considered. And I've asked for that to change. And I'm pleased that a lot of the recommendations that I put forward are being moved. Obviously, at the moment, nothing's happening until our election. But actually, these are the kind of things I want to see, because what I do is I liken this to other crimes of vulnerability. And if we're going to call this a crime, and I do continuously say this is a serious crime, because if somebody came forward who had been the victim of another serious crime, rape, serious assaults, the next question wouldn't be, where's your passport? So we need to change the culture. of how we approach that. Your question about prostitution and if legalising it would work or if decriminalising the purchase of it, I'm the Commissioner for England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. England and Wales has got legislation, Scotland's got separate as Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland and the entire Republic of Ireland, so the island of Ireland, the purchase of sex has now just been criminalised. So I'm going to monitor that over the next 12 to 18 months, 2 years, to see how effective, to see what impact that has had. So that I can see that, I know there's Nordic models and other models, but how I can see that actually impacts on a British sort of status and a British mind. But it's something that needs to be thought about. But we do know that traffickers for many, many years have been sourcing vulnerable young women and girls and exporting them and trading in them in the sex industry, not just in the UK, but that's a global issue. And it's something that we really need to start to understand properly.
Jennifer Byrne, Anti-Slavery Australia. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for your compelling call to capture the momentum to end slavery. And I agree with all the comments that have been made about the depth of your presentation tonight. Thank you. Thinking about the Modern Slavery Act and the current Australian inquiry into whether we should establish such an act in Australia, can you look back and perhaps give us advice about any recommendations that you think we should consider in the drafting of legislation here?
So I think with our act around the supply chain transparency, there was a bit of confusion, or quite a bit of confusion still, about a central repository, what that should look like. So I think that's something you need to consider, because I'm considering it in the UK. I don't think it should sit with me, because I think it could affect independence. And I want to be able to say what I want to say about statements, as opposed to something that I've got a responsibility for. But I do think there is a place to look at how that is managed. So that's one element about the supply chain transparency. But I think there are offences you can consider and think about. How do you prevent? Yes, we've got risk orders and prevention orders, which go through the courts, are quite a process to get them, very effective. They've been used quite a number of times. But there are a number of other things you could consider about that prevention, about withholding of passports, about the way contracts are drafted, about the way people are given their rights, if they're, particularly if they're migrant workers, what they're informed of. Because since our act came in, one of the things I asked our government to do was about changing our tied visa towards domestic workers. And thankfully, they've agreed that. We no longer have a tied visa. So we've learned on our journey, but you could actually incorporate this in your legislation. The other thing that I have said consistently is where you start with this. Once you have legislation, we took a little bit of time to get somewhere about our supply chain transparency, about our criminality. Now I'm very clear about what this is. Serious and organised crime, the trade in human lives. That's number one. But the second part is it's actually being fueled by our commercial trading globally. If you start off with a very clear picture of what it is, it took us a while to get there. We were talking about it as a social issue. How do we respond to it? We need to work with NGOs, most essentially work with NGOs, because they've got the real value. But there was no resource behind it. There was no law enforcement pursuing it. There was no intelligence services, no National Crime Agency, our FBI. Now we've got them there. We're seeing the whole picture change. We're seeing more victims come forward. That's key. Why are they coming forward? Because they know they'll get a response. We're seeing our immigration services referring victims. Our actual immigration service, that wasn't there before. So the fact that they know it's a serious crime and there's a response that needs to happen. But then also through our supply chain statements. But today when I spoke to some of the business sector, I said, you own the responsibility. You as the private sector. Because they will start looking to say, where can this sit? Who can help us? Who can write our statements? No, you as the business. Just like you do other bits of auditing, just like you do your accounts, this needs to be part of your business. You own it and you make sure it works. Because otherwise it all becomes muddled. We kind of got muddled. We're out of that and we now have some clarity. That's part of my role. But I think it's essential that you have that from the start, perhaps learn from our slow start, and you can end up flying much quicker than we do.
I mean, I just wondered if you could rate Australia's overall sort of approach to the slavery issue. You've talked about the legislative approach and you've talked about some of the actions that are happening in Vietnam, but do you think Australia falls behind in this area, and what could be done more broadly, including, for example, you know, police powers and so on?
I mean, the fact that Australia is looking at this in this way means it's a positive step. I think, you know, you're taking the right direction. I'm here because I would like you to have a modern slavery act. I would like you to have a lot of the measures that we've got. I can't dictate what Australia has because I don't really understand the legal systems, albeit I know they're very similar to ours. You've got some very good legislation in your criminal codes. There's some things they don't do. You've got protection for victims in your amendments to your criminal codes. So there are things there that are good. But one of the things that happened with our Modern Slavery Act, a lot of people around the world say, what's that term? It's got no legal standing, the term modern slavery. Well, neither is the criminal code, neither as ours was Sexual Offences Act, neither is Immigration and Asylum Act. The name doesn't really have legal standing or legal definition. Yes, human trafficking has, obviously under the Palermo Protocols and UN conventions. But actually, if you're trying to sell this to people, if you're trying to get your law enforcement, your immigration, your criminal justice system, your health service, your local councils, the UK, for example, and you want to get businesses involved in it, start telling them they're dealing with modern slavery. They're like it was back in the 1800s, because nothing's changed. It's exactly like it was in the days of Wilberforce. It's about finding vulnerable people and getting them to do our trade so that we can benefit with cheap goods and criminals profit in the middle. I mean, back then, obviously, it wasn't a crime. So actually, it's about clarity of what you want it to do, and then perhaps using a name that people might find uncomfortable. But it's much easier for me to sell modern slavery to our communities and to our business sector and to my law enforcement agencies, because when they're looking at modern slavery at 3 o'clock in the morning when they found a victim, they view it as serious. When they were looking at a victim under the Immigration Asylum Act, they were thinking this person might need to go into a cell because they're illegally in the UK. So what you pitch it as does actually have a consequence on how it's reacted to.
Well, thank you again. I think that's all the time that we have for questions. Thank you. It's a very sobering and very disturbing topic that you have shed a lot of light on tonight. Thank you again for coming tonight. It was a really fantastic speech.